Good afternoon. Welcome to the 487th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. Since its founding more than 40 years ago, the forum has been meeting monthly to hear from an invited speaker on a topic central to U.S. foreign policy. At today's meeting, we are pleased to have Ambassador Christopher Hill to speak on foreign policy challenges in uncertain times. Ambassador Christopher R. Hill is a professional American diplomat who has served under seven presidents since entering the U.S. Foreign Service in 1977. Ambassador Hill is a five-time ambassador across multiple regions in Senate-confirmed positions, including as ambassador to Iraq, the Republic of Korea, Poland, North Macedonia, and most recently to the Republic of Serbia until January of 2025. He was the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs under Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. As the senior U.S. negotiator, Ambassador Hill led U.S. efforts at the six-party talks to end North Korea's nuclear weapons program in 2005 to 2009. Earlier, he was a lead State Department negotiator in Dayton, Ohio, the process that ended the war in Bosnia. Later, he was a U.S. special envoy in negotiations that led to the end of the Kosovo War. In addition, Ambassador Hill served as a senior director in the National Security Staff and as a special assistant to President Clinton. He earned a Bachelor of Arts at Bowdoin College and a Master of Arts from the Naval War College. Outside of the Foreign Service, he was the dean of the Corbel School at the University of Denver and taught at Columbia University. He began his career as a Peace Corps volunteer in West Africa. Chris, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you very much, George. It's a great honor to be here in the Midcoast Forum. And what am I, number 488? It's unbelievable. And may there be many more in the future. So I'm going to talk about all the trouble we're in right now in the world. But I mentioned this, it's not a joke because it really happened. I mentioned this to a few people last night, and again, it comes from Poland. But there was this Polish party first secretary, Communist Party first secretary, way before Jaruzelski, named Władysław Gomułka. Władysław Gomułka's name is otherwise lost to history. And he was known for very long speeches and very unsuccessful metaphors. And one time he stood in front of a crowd in Kraków and he said, "Comrades, just a few years ago, our fatherland stood on the very edge of a deep abyss. And I'm here to tell you today, comrades, we have taken an important step forward." So as we talk about where our country's going and what we're trying to do, let's be careful about that step forward. Seriously, these are very difficult times. And you know, for many people in the world, it's perplexing because when you look at the United States, I mean, frankly, a lot of people want to live here, maybe not right now, but they've certainly wanted to live here for a long time. It's considered, and with good reason, the most successful country ever. There's just been nothing like it in the world. And if you think about the run we've had since World War II, obviously a terrible time in world history and a time where the U.S., frankly, came to the rescue. And then as importantly, after World War II, the United States took the lead in creating the systems in the world, whether IMF, World Bank, UN, all these systems, to try to make sure the world never was cast into that situation again. So if you look at these things, they were all done in our own image because they were created by people who came before us. There were people who I mean, if you look at the first three words of the UN Charter, it's we the peoples. I mean, where do you think that came from? And so if you look at, and this was 1945, if you look at even before the war ended, the Bretton Woods, not very far from here, to create international monetary systems, and it's just extraordinary. Then we took the task of saying, okay, we need security systems around the world. So some of these things didn't last, but, you know, like CENTO, which was a security system in the Middle East, CETO, Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, again, it didn't last, but it lasted for a certain amount of time, at a time when you're trying to protect the world from Soviet aggression. And of course, the granddaddy of them all that has lasted, and that's NATO. And we did this all in our own image. And yet, over these decades, since all this happened, you get a growing percentage of Americans, and I'm not just talking about the current president, this has been going on for some decades, a growing percentage of Americans who feel that we are the victims. That somehow our largesse has never been reciprocated, that we have been chumps, that other countries have taken advantage of us, and boy, we gotta stop that. I would submit to you that we're not victims. And most people in the world would agree that we're not victims. Even the countries that hate us certainly don't see us as a victim. They see us as a country that has sometimes pushed its weight around, that has sometimes not cracked the inside of a history book when we've dealt with complex subjects, that has, as in Winston Churchill's great phrase, a country that does the right thing, but only after it's exhausted all the other possibilities. So there's a lot of sort of resentment to us. I mean, as a Red Sox fan, I've felt the same way about the Yankees. And so you can understand how many people sort of saw us there. And yet, in America itself, we've looked at these people as somehow not having enough gratitude toward what we've done. I submit to you, it's just completely wrong. And while some countries have regretted our being, you know, engaged in their own internal affairs, most of the regrets are when we're not engaged in these issues. And I have heard over and over in my career, this issue will only be resolved when the United States takes an interest in resolving it. Now, sometimes we haven't really known what we're doing. We've made some foolish decisions. But once we're engaged, we tend to be, you know, that tends to be the end of the game. We're not a fourth inning pitcher. We come in on the ninth inning, and that's that. And so we've been very successful with that. And I think with so many Americans questioning in so many ways our engagement in the world, that questioning has led to, as it often does, led to a lack of self-confidence. And I think to some extent we've been unwilling to engage, saying, well, they don't really want us there. Why should we be engaged in there? And what this has led to is a more dangerous world, a world where conflict, which we thought we would get rid of conflict at a certain time, well, we haven't gotten rid of it. It's back with a vengeance. And so we're going to have to deal with some of this. One of the problems, and again, I'm here to talk generally about American foreign policy, and I'm not making a political speech, but when you have taken aim at the State Department as being the root of all problems, you're basically saying, yes, we need diplomacy, but we don't need diplomats. And I have a problem with that approach. And I think right now we're in a situation where we simply are undermanned for the task. I am not in any way disparaging the role of real estate developers in solving issues, but I would like to suggest that we need some more professional diplomats, and that currency of those professional diplomats has been very much depleted as the force of diplomats is also being depleted. So I think we're going to have to kind of come together and decide what we want to be when we grow up. And I think the country really continues to have something to offer. And I think in the future, and I do believe in the future in this country, and I am not a declinist, I think we're going to have to reverse some of these trends and get a grip on these issues. You know, some years ago, it was during the Obama administration, back in 2014, there was a realization that the Europeans had taken seriously the idea of a peace dividend in the 1990s. So you had this extraordinary thing happen, the collapse of the Berlin Wall, the emergence of these countries that were independent countries before World War II and had become members of the Warsaw Pact against their will. And these countries were once again on the European landscape. And the Europeans essentially turned their attention from military spending, which is something we needed them to do because the best way to prevent war is to have military spending. And so these countries turned their attention really to trying to help these countries. If you would, it was kind of a division of labor. We would increasingly be the factor in NATO, the military factor in NATO. The Europeans would increasingly be the factor in helping these economies, these nascent economies, get on their feet. It wasn't easy, and I think it is fair to say that the Europeans overdrew on the peace dividend, with the consequence that we looked around and we saw that the only country really contributing to the common defense was the United States. I remember at the start of the Kosovo War, a story in and of itself, one of the generals who, and by the way, the U.S. runs NATO's military, and make no mistake about that, one of the American generals said to me, The good news is we have 520 strike aircraft ready to do whatever needs to be done in terms of halting Serbia's attacks on Kosovo. But the bad news is that of those 520 strike aircraft, 510 were American. And so clearly there needed to be some adjustment there. But I stress the word adjustment. And I don't stress the word sort of revolutionary change. And people who think that this country needs to be fundamentally turned upside down simply have no appreciation for what this country has done, nor much appreciation for how we do it, which is to try to work through difficult problems and achieve consensus. So we saw in 2019 the Europeans kind of wake up on this, and everyone agreed in NATO to do 2%. 2% GDP should be devoted to the military. Not a bad start. Some countries were already there. Many countries were not. Germany was barely at 1%. Now, I hasten to add, these issues have some historical context that many Americans don't really think through. You can imagine there are small countries in Europe not thrilled with the idea of a major German rearmament. But on the other hand, Germany is one of the stalwart members of the alliance and also one of the strongest democracies in Europe and one of the most capable countries, and we wanted to see more. So fast forward now to a few months ago, and there we saw that the U.S. government is again pushing countries not just to be 2%, but 3.5%, actually 5% if you add so-called military infrastructure. And lo and behold, the European country said, okay, we'll do it. And so before you know it, we've seen a lot of budgets in Europe going way up. Now, one factor, obviously, is Ukraine, which I'll get to in a minute. But another factor is you ask yourself, are they more pliable toward U.S. requests? I mean, it was not easy to get them to 2%. There's a lot of arm twisting. So how do they get there? And the answer is, it's not that they're more pliable to our requests, but this time, whereas in 2019, they paid 2% each in order to keep the U.S. engaged in NATO, this time they'll pay 3.5% because they think we're leaving. And I think that is problematic for our security relations in Europe, And I think it's very problematic from the point of view of making sure that Russia understands that in continuing to wage this war, Ukraine, not only are they going up against very capable Ukrainian forces, not only are they going up against Europeans who have been backing Ukraine, but they're going up against the United States. And I think that is the way to dissuade Russia from this continued aggression. If there's a perception, if a perception develops that we are in fact leaving Europe, that the Article 5, which is the clause in the Washington Agreement that created NATO that says an attack on one is an attack on all, if there's a perception that this clause doesn't mean anything anymore, I think we can expect more conflict, not less. So one does worry where we are and whether we have been able to use the right amount of diplomatic language, but also the right amount of empathy and engagement with the Europeans to assure them that they need to do their part, and as they do their part, we'll do our part. And so I think there is this concern that we're not going to be around for this. By the way, I would tell you that this Ukraine struggle has been tough. I mean, to be sure, the proposition that sent Putin's forces into Ukraine, which was that the Ukrainians don't really—they're not really Ukrainian. They're just Russian. They just don't know it yet. But surely, when the Russians succeed after a couple of weeks, you'll see the Ukrainians very happy to be once again part of Mother Russia. That didn't happen, and it's unlikely to happen. In fact, I think when the history books are written, to talk about one of the fathers of Ukrainian nationalism, you would have to put Vladimir Putin as one of those, because he's done more for Ukrainian nationalism than any Ukrainian ever has. So we have a situation now where it's clearer and clearer this is just a war of aggression, and the question is, what are we going to do about it? Have the Ukrainians fought it? Have they done enough on their own? The answer is yes, they have. Have they taken the brunt of it? Oh, indeed they have. And are they going to prevail? Do they have the capacity to hang in there? You bet they do. So the issue is, are we going to help them, or are we going to try to say, hey, we'll help you, but you got to help us, and go into some kind of real estate deal or something. And so my hope, and hope is never a good basis for diplomacy or for policy, but my hope is that we will continue to engage in Ukraine and engage in a way that the Russians will understand that no amount of bluster, no amount of drone strikes into Ukraine or killing Ukrainian children, or worse yet, stealing Ukrainian children into Russia, or sending drones into Poland, or sending drones into Romania, or sending strike aircraft into Estonia, that this stuff is not going to work. And the way you show that it's not going to work is you remain steady at the helm and you do what needs to be done. I believe that we're seeing a greater understanding of that proposition, that we, whereas the new administration came in with a view that somehow this could be fixed if the Ukrainians could be more flexible, have come to understand that it's really far more complex. And it requires something that Americans aren't really good at, that is sticking with something in the long haul. By the way, the irony of that, so many countries have said, well, the Americans won't really hang around there. But look at how long we've been in some of these wars. I mean, look at how long we were in Vietnam. And for those who are extremely critical of the withdrawal from Afghanistan, also need to answer the question, well, how long would you have wanted us to stay there? So, I mean, the U.S. has a pretty good record of staying power because most of our leadership has tried to come together, and the Ukrainian example is very strong. You have a lot of Republicans in the Congress who feel very strongly about Ukraine, and that I think ultimately we can, with the right leadership and the right incentive structure, get together and make sure that Russia is unsuccessful. It's extremely important to have friends and allies, and I think with Europe, we need to do a better job of dealing with those friends and allies. There, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, there's a lot of doubts about whether we're prepared to stay the course there. But I think ultimately the Europeans understand that it's really about the North Atlantic relationship, and if there's a break there, nothing good can come of that. I remember back, I was in Poland as ambassador back in 2002, and as the Europeans were looking at the next stages of the enlargement of the European Union, there was increasingly a kind of effort to define Europe in a different way from the United States, to accent the differences between Europe and the United States. So the Europeans would say, well, we're in favor of the Kyoto Climate Agreement, the Americans are not. We're opposed to death penalty, the Americans support the death penalty, and sort of looking for all these areas where we actually had differences from Europe. There's a lot less of that talk and a real understanding that we need to hang together or we're going to hang separately. So we have to watch that space in Europe. We have to calm this down with the European Union, with the Europeans. We have to respect the historical project they've been on. We have to kind of understand a little better what this European Union project is, because the European Union project is not just about, you know, providing for each other's economies. The European Union project was to create a circumstance where Europe again will never again be plunged into war. It started, after all, with the French-German coal agreement. I mean, this goes back to the 1950s, to keep France and Germany from to integrate their economies in a way that they will never go to war with each other again. So it is a project that I think in the annals of world history is something worthy of our respect. And of course there are problems. Of course they, in trying to deepen the structures, they go into bureaucratic things like, you know, what size bananas should be imported for free in Europe. If you've ever been to Europe, they tend to be small bananas, and the reason is those come from a French Caribbean islands. So they're trying to, the French were trying to make sure that they had cornered the banana market, on and on. It doesn't really matter. What matters is a European Union that is up to the task, that has the self-confidence, has the backing of the United States to continue to realize the project of a Europe whole and free and at peace. So it's, I think the European Union is really, if you go through centuries of European history, there's just nothing like it. And I think it's kind of time we understood the importance of it. Moving around the globe, though, there's this place called China. And, I spent a lot of time there. What was I doing in China? I was dealing with North Korea in China. Now, today, I think a lot of these things have gone wrong, and I point my finger at the Chinese for why many of these things have gone wrong. I think Xi Jinping, frankly speaking, has been a great disappointment to American policymakers and American people themselves. I think there's this perception that when he came in, after all, this is a guy who spent a summer in Iowa, on a farm in Iowa, and everyone thought, well, that should cinch the deal. He's going to love us forever. Not coincidentally, I spent a summer on a farm in Rhode Island digging potatoes, and I never kind of got around to the view that that's what I should do in my life. But so Xi Jinping came in with this expectation that we're going to see a more democratized China. We're going to see a China that kind of sees us as their main partner rather than other countries who are democratically challenged. And in that regard, I mean, North Korea, I mean, those are people only a mother can love. I tell you, I worked with them, and it was a terrible effort. But the Chinese kind of, you could see they could understand that we Chinese have to care more about the Americans than we do with the North Koreans. So, you know, I'd come up with sort of typical American ideas, like, and I'll explain that. And the Chinese kind of looked at me, not sure they'd do it, but they did it because they valued the relationship with us. One typical American idea was we were taking the North Korean nuclear facility, a place called Yongbyon facility, not to be confused with Yongpyeong, which is a ski resort in South Korea. Yongbyon was a nuclear resort in North Korea where they were taking spent fuel from the reactor and reprocessing it into plutonium. So the idea was to dismantle the reactor. So we worked very closely with the Chinese. They know something about producing nuclear energy. And so we looked at 12 steps. I don't know why I did 12. It just seemed appropriate. And we'd have ideas like there would be an exhaust system. So saw the exhaust system off such that you're not going to be able to use the facility. So I remember I had nuclear experts, and I'd say, does that sound like that could work? He said, yeah, if you can get that, that'll work. So I would press on with that. But the totality of these 12 things didn't really amount to a lot in terms of people believing that we were on the right course. So I remember I'm sitting there, I'm holding my notes, and sitting there with a Chinese nuclear negotiator, and Wu Dawei, and I said, we need something that Americans can really understand. And he said, what do you mean? And I took my notes, and I said, you know that cooling tower on the nuclear facility? We need to take that cooling tower, and I stood up my notes like this, and we needed to collapse that cooling tower, blow it up. And Wu Dawei looked at me, he looked at the other Chinese, he wasn't sure what to do, and he said, I see what you're talking about. So 2 months later, we get the cooling tower blown up. It was, by the way, it was typical North Korean, because they said, well, it'll cost $3 million to do. And of course, all our counter-proliferation people, well, they should pay for it themselves. Fortunately, we had some wisdom at the Secretary of State, someone named Condi Rice, and she said, find the money, get the money, and blow the thing up. And so that's what we did, and we did it together with the Chinese. So those were kind of heady days. It didn't mean that we were on our way necessarily to solving North Korea, but I felt we were kind of on our way to developing some very important patterns of communication, patterns of thought with the Chinese. And alas, that seems to have been lost in the intervening decade and a half. The Chinese have clearly lost a lot of trust in us, and we've lost a lot of trust in them. China's not going anywhere. There are about 1 billion people, and even if you declare, as we have, that the Indo-Pacific is one ocean, it's not. There are two oceans there, last time I checked a map. And there's nothing wrong with our getting closer to India, but don't expect India to start helping to manage security in the Pacific, and don't expect India to change its view of China. They have a lot of problems with China, but we're not going to be able to solve this problem through India. So we now have a situation where the Chinese, I think, are really in a different place. The trust levels have never been lower. I must say, Xi Jinping came in with this declaration that he was going to deal with corruption in China, and who's against corruption. But in dealing with corruption in China, he actually corrupted the anti-corruption program in China. So people were accused of corruption who weren't necessarily guilty of corruption, and before you knew it, you had political purges. And once you start with political purges, you're usually going in the wrong direction. So I think there's a long way back with China. China, in the meantime, has gotten very aggressive with the countries around it. For many Americans, they look at this and go, why would the Chinese be aggressive with these countries and think, you know, how this is pure imperialism? And there's a lot of that, but you have to understand that in the previous one or 2,000 years, China was
dealt with these countries as tributary states. We wanted them to deal with these countries as sovereigns. The Treaty of Westphalia, everyone who studied European history knows about the Treaty of Westphalia and the creation of the sovereignty concepts. And it's going to take a while with the Chinese. And while this is not an easy project dealing with China, I submit to you, it's better to deal with them than deal against them, because China is a tough nut to crack. And I think we're going to have to do a little better job of dealing with them and see if we can have some rules of the road. There's no question the Chinese have been extremely aggressive and, frankly, unfair on issues of technology. They've been aggressive and unfair on issues of economy, issues of investment. To see the intellectual property rights theft that we've seen in China over the years. For a while, I think we foolishly ignored some of this, saying we got bigger fish to fry, and we ignored some of this. We can't ignore it anymore. Anyone who's looked at the New York Times, I think it was today or yesterday, and sees what China is doing on energy, that should be a real moment for pause, where we are producing more oil and gas, where China is looking to be they produce more solar energy than the rest of the world combined, and we need to take that seriously. This is going to be done by an understanding, a carefully calibrated approach on negotiations. We need to work with allies, because if we think we can just have tariffs on China while other countries don't, we're going to see trade diversion to other countries. We're going to put ourselves in a worse position, and we need to handle it with other countries, and we need friends and allies. Napoleon, who made a few mistakes, once said that my greatest strength is that I have no allies. Wrong again. Not just because of Waterloo, but the fact is you need allies. Allies, you know, as frustrating as it is to work in these multilateral meetings and to say, come on, why can't we work? Can't we get this? It's very frustrating. But if you don't have allies, your reach is going to be much impaired, and so there needs to be a much better understanding of how to deal with allies. Finally, because I know we're going to go to questions how am I doing on time? 5 more minutes. I would be really remiss if I didn't talk about what is going on in the Middle East today. I served in Iraq. And one of the things I took from Iraq was the fact that not only are the issues difficult, but what is on people's mind may not be what you think is on their minds. For example, I never heard anyone in Iraq talk about the plight of the Palestinians. If you can imagine, you have this country which is 30 million people, all of whom are Muslim, and no one seemed to care about the Palestinians. We seem to care more about them, and I think appropriately so, because the Middle East, if you look at a map, there are a lot of Palestinians right in the middle of it and in the middle of Israel, and the question is, how do you manage this? And it's obviously extremely difficult. I think we have seen in the middle, you have Sunni Arab states. And one of the problems with Iraq was we go in there and we say, okay, we're going to have free elections. Well, when you have free elections and you have no institutions to speak of, who do you think people vote for in elections? Do you think they vote for, well, that party's offering lower taxes, that party's offering more? No, it doesn't work that way. If you're a Sunni in Iraq, you voted for a Sunni candidate. If you were a Shia in Iraq, you voted for the Shia, and the Kurds, believe me, always vote for the Kurds. So, you know, elections were really kind of a hard way to determine kind of the way forward. So you need more complex approaches to it. So I saw that in Iraq, no one really cared about the Palestinians, but anyone who's looked at this issue over the years knows that this issue is not going away unless there's a process. And I would support the long-standing approach of many different U.S. presidents that it's going to eventually have to be some kind of two-state solution. In the meantime, you have Iran seeing a Shia Iraqi state, because the Iranians are Shia, or at least they've been Shia since about 1501, but because they flipped at that point, because that's when the Seljuk and Ottoman Turks began to put pressure on the rest of the Middle East, who were Sunni, and so the Iranian leadership at the time turned Iran in a very bloody process into Shia. And in fact, they brought Shia clerics from places like Lebanon. So this is kind of one of those who knew type detail, but you know, you gotta know a little about this stuff if you're going to, you know, take a role in it. So we had a situation where the Iranians see a real opportunity in Iraq. They saw a real opportunity in Lebanon, and a real opportunity in Syria to prevent the emergence of Sunni in Syria, and to be very aggressive about it. And the Iranians, in addition to Nazarelli and these other people who were the center of Shia life in Syria, the Iranians were also using Hamas against other Sunni groups, but also against Israel. So whoever miscalculated, I would blame the Hamas leadership, because I don't think they have a clue of how to proceed with Israel, because Israel is not going away any more than China is going away. And so they began an insurrection on October 7th. They killed over 1,000 Israelis. They took hundreds of Israelis, 2,000 Israelis actually. They took hundreds of Israelis hostage, and they began a kind of life and death struggle that very few Israeli leadership could back away from. It happened to come at a time when Netanyahu was going through very difficult problems politically in Israel. You know, lots of problems, but the overall effect of this was that this bloodbath, including 65,000 people from Gaza killed, thousands of Israelis also, or at least hundreds killed, and then finally yesterday we get a kind of way forward. It's a 20-point plan, and I can tell you as someone who's worked on ceasefires, they never work unless people know what the next phase is. I mean, if people say, well, gee, we have a ceasefire today, and tomorrow we're going to have something that I know the basic contours of it, so I'll go on along with the ceasefire, because no one wants to be the last person to die in a civil war. And I think that has been the bane of the existence of many ceasefires, that they don't work because people never know what the next stage is. But in this case, it's a 20-point plan. There's a lot of support for the latter phases of it. They haven't been close to being implemented, but there's some hope, and I think some justified hope, that this may actually help. We had the remaining hostages released this morning, the Israeli hostages. We had 1,968 Arabs released, including 250 Palestinians who were in life sentences in Israel, usually on terrorism charges. But we had the remainder of people from Gaza, many of whom were Hamas. They're all being released today. They've had bodies and caskets released. So it's a big day for the release process. The hope is that, you know, most wars end when people are exhausted and don't want to fight more. But in that case, this is a case of hope over experience, because it seems that in the Middle East, ceasefires have been an opportunity to rearm. So we still have to see where this is going, but frankly, it's the right thing to do, and I hope they can build on this. one of the issues is you've got to, you know, it's like any basketball team. If you're, you know, scored 10 points, the other team calls a timeout, and then somehow you can't score point 11. We got to keep the momentum, and I hope we do. And with that, I think George is giving me the kind of high. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Thank you.
I think you've given us a tremendous amount to think about, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of questions. While we're collecting questions, I always take the opportunity to ask the first one. You talked about, you know, Europe, Asia, Middle East. Is the U.S. in the position, are we in the same position of strength that we were during the Cold War, during post-World War II, where we can dictate things and control the situation throughout the world, or are we becoming overextended?
I don't think we're in the same position we were during the depth of the Cold War. I think part of it is that a lot of countries have shown the fruits of, really, the fruits of our success. I mean, Europe is standing very tall. I mean, you talk to a European, they always say, oh, we've got terrible problems, which they do, but Europe, I think, is, if you look at per capita income, I mean, we are still probably the strongest in the world, but I think we've seen a Europe that has come on strong. I think Europe has taken on some of the other projects, but I do worry about the decision, essentially, to end AID, Agency for International Development. Again, it was kind of a Cold War phenomena. John Kennedy created it. And the idea was to show the American generosity. And I think we did a very good job. It doesn't mean that every aid project was a brilliant project. You know, as anyone has been out in the field and you're talking to your aid director and he or she says, well, you know, we have this new project to have seminars and such, and then you go, huh, why are we doing that? I mean, you know, and with aid, it was always, oh, you're either too late or you're too early, you know, because they'd have these kind of long von Schlieffen plans for how to provide this assistance. So it was kind of frustrating. But my goodness, that doesn't mean you kill the whole thing. I mean, you work on it, and you kind of come up with something that that can go forward. I have a real problem with the world's richest country, which is what we are today and what we've been for decades. I have a real problem with the world's richest country not able to provide any official assistance to the world's poorest countries. And I think... and... just, you asked, George, so let me just, you know, I mean, there's this argument, well, yes, we're a very generous nation, and and we have the private sector providing a lot of assistance, and therefore, you know, we don't have to have this from the government. That's wrong, because the private sector quite often looks to a signal from the government. So if there's country X out there and it's unclear what the issues are, is it a terrible government? Is it, you know, it'll be the private sector looks to the U.S. government for the nod whether to help that country. And by the way, a lot of assistance has to be given to countries with terrible governments. That's just the reality of it. But you don't make three-year-old kids starve because they have a terrible government. So...
the first three questions I picked up were all about Russia. And one of them is, do you have an explanation for the soft stance by the current administration on Putin?
I think there is a belief that, you know, the logic of all this is for the Russians to cease and desist. The logic of this is that they're weakening their economy by the day, and you know, you've probably seen these articles about renewed drone strikes from the Ukrainians into Russian energy sources, which aimed at trying to get the Russian people to be kind of engaged in trying to stop the war. So the logic of this is to have a situation where Russia wants to end it, but logic is not the most operative element in Mr. Putin's head, and so it's gone on, and I think he proved to be far more stubborn than our administration expected him to be. I can understand any administration feeling, all right, I will talk to that guy and see what we can do. I think we took the view that somehow a talking to would be enough for Putin to stop, and it hasn't been. So I hope there's some reassessment going on, but what I really hope is that the American people and the American and elected people understand that we can't lose this fight. We cannot lose this. We cannot have a situation where some years from now people will say, well, you know, why did we give up on that as we see other countries go under? Because the problem, if you're Estonia, the problem is, or if you're Albania, or if you're one of these tiny little NATO states, you know, North Macedonia, you have to believe that Article 5 means that an attack on little Macedonia will be an attack on all, and therefore the U.S. will be there to protect Macedonia. You've got to believe that. Otherwise, you'll find some other solutions, and those other solutions will often put you in a gray area between East and West, and you'll be in a much worse position. So I think we need to really hold firm here. We are very fortunate that the Ukrainians every day are giving their lives for their country. We are very fortunate. No one is asking us to send U.S. troops there, but they are asking us to be, as Roosevelt told Churchill in 1940, the arsenal of democracy, and I think we should continue to be that.
Then here's a question that goes to the consistency of the current administration's policy. This morning in his speech in Jerusalem, Trump said that we will have to defeat Russia. Is that an offhand statement?
I think he's gleaned the fact that Putin thinks that he can somehow wear us out. There's always been this view that somehow Americans are the pursuit of happiness has meant for us this idea that we want to get out of these things as soon as possible and go on being happy. And I think, first of all, they've misunderstood that provision of our Constitution. And secondly, they've underestimated us.
Well, to pivot then to the other part, another part of the world, when you talked about China, you didn't talk about Taiwan.
Yeah. I think that is a huge problem. China has defined Taiwan as, you know, the beginning of a sort of, you know, if they lose Taiwan forever, they'll lose Western provinces forever. I mean, within China, and that there's a lot of centrifugal forces that are only held together by a strong Beijing, and so I think they really worry that as the years go by, Taiwan has developed its own identity. I mean, to go to Taiwan is not to hear people say, well, we're all Chinese and we look forward to reoccupying China. That kind of has gone by after Chiang Kai-shek. So you get a kind of different view. I must say, when I was in Taiwan and I wanted to go see Chiang Kai-shek's grave, which is kind of the size of the Lincoln Memorial, except double the size. And so I told the Taiwan foreign ministry people I wanted to go see that, and they said, well, no one ever goes there anymore. And I said, well, I'd like to go. So so we go there, and it's just packed with people. And I turned to this Chinese woman who's from, or a Taiwan woman from the south in Taiwan. No sense of her parents ever came from Japan, from the mainland. So I said, what do you mean? You said no one cares about this anymore. And look at these people. And then she said to me, without any sense of irony, well, they're all from the mainland. And I said, even better. I said, ask this woman, why is she here? And where is she from? And why is she here? The woman was, of course, from the mainland. And I said, now ask her, why is she here? And the woman answered, because Chiang Kai-shek was a great Christian. So, you know, in short, things are complicated. And I do worry about, you know, in China, you know, some things that you just can't resolve and you've got to kind of live with, but I'm afraid this is coming to a head at some point. And what is very worrisome is the increasing use of force in on territorial issues. A few years ago, I would have said to you, China will never, ever use force to solve this. I hope that's still true, but I think it's very problematic. And I think what China needs to understand is their relationship with us is more important and more valuable than this renegade province, as they call it, of Taiwan.
And here's a question sticking with China for a second on the influence that China has in the world, not just in Asia. Are they still forging ahead with their Belt and Road Initiative, and how effective?
Yeah, I think, first of all, China has tremendous influence throughout the world in a way that we could have not imagined several decades ago. Belt and Road, which for those of you who haven't heard the term, refers to the idea of China essentially going to countries and making offers of to help build infrastructure, ports, etc., which have a kind of strategic importance as the Chinese sell this at home, a strategic importance in terms of extending China's reach. It was first called the Silk Road Initiative because it involves the Marco Polo's discovery of trade with China, but it seems to be much bigger factor. I think it started with fiscal imbalances and the need to help construction companies, really as prosaic as that, but I think now it has become a strategic issue, and I think the problem is going to Sri Lanka or whatever and telling them not to take money from the Chinese and then not offering money of your own is not a winning hand. And if we want to take it seriously, and I think we should, we need to understand that good diplomacy requires serious money. So, and I'm not sure that's quite understood these days. Yeah.
Here's another one that's asking, if you are positive that in the future we can have a sounder relationship with...
Yeah, I do. I think China, first of all, in the history of China, I mentioned their relationship with the near abroad, which doesn't come up to the level of inspiration because it's often a tributary relationship and they expect these smaller countries to be paying tribute. But China has no sort of global reach, global effort to, take over Europe. That said, I think we need to be very conscious of the fact that it's not so much the old geostrategic issues that we need to worry about. It's more the Chinese cornering on new technologies. And I'd like to mention that it's taken me 58 minutes to mention AI, which I think is a new record in speakers. But there's no question there's a lot to be concerned about in China taking the next, getting to the next stage of technology before we are. They are extremely talented people, and we need to be aware of this, and I think concerned about it. And I would say we need to invest more heavily than the Chinese and stay ahead of them. That's obviously, when you talk about investment for the sake of staying ahead of someone, it sounds a little, kind of retro thinking. But I think if we're concerned about China getting ahead of us, we're not going to realize those concerns by pulling them back. We're going to realize those by pushing us forward. And I think we need to be much more serious about it for ourselves. You know, a lot of the problems with China have to do with the problems in this country. When I see you can't build a windmill in this country without it turning into it. You can't even have a Mother's Day resolution without a big political thing. Well, the Chinese, I don't know if they have Mother's Day resolutions, but they sure have a lot of windmills. And I think we need to get more serious about tomorrow's energy.
Then let me move to... let me move to the Middle East. And someone has a question on... what will be our future relationship with Israel? Has the war in Gaza change that relationship?
I think the war, I mean, if you look at polling data in the U.S., the war in Gaza has changed that relationship. I think the big question will be, where is Netanyahu after all the dust settles? I think if you look at American Jewish communities who have always been the bulwark of U.S. support in Israel, I mean, if you look at the polling data, there's a distinct lack of enthusiasm for Mr. Netanyahu. Maybe that'll change as a result of the last 2 days. I'm not so sure. I think there's a sense that Israel's outgrown him, and we'll have to see. So I think it's too early to say. I will say that Israel has been a great ally. When you're an ambassador, I was in Serbia, in these other countries, and the Israeli ambassador was always a guy you really wanted to talk to. I think the Israelis, you know, despite all the issues with Netanyahu, are a country that they're a country that shares our values, so I don't count them out at all.
And then someone wants to know your view of Gutter's being given the okay to have this training facility.
I don't know enough about it, but if there's ever an idea that sounded like a bad one, that's, again, I have to punt on that because maybe there's a lot of stuff I don't know about, but it didn't sit well with me.
Thank you. And that's, you didn't talk about Latin America.
I know, because we had a certain
Venezuela,
amount of time,
Cuba,
but
Colombia.
I think Brazil is a country on the rise, and I kind of worry about how we're handling that right now. I think Latin America has for decades had legitimate concerns that we don't pay enough attention, and as this talk I just gave would suggest, they are right. I think the Latin America has done a lot to try to bring countries together, and I think small states, and newsflash here, I'm going to be teaching a course at Fletcher School at Tufts University. Last time I dealt with Tufts University, I was on the Bowdoin lacrosse team, and we beat them 15-7. But at Tufts, at Fletcher School, I'll be teaching a course on small states and the need for small states to band together at a time when the big states, that is the great powers, can't seem to agree on anything. And I think Latin America is doing that, and Central American organizations and others. And I think we would do well to pay more attention.
Thank you very, very much.